From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Many advocating an artificial timetable for withdrawing our troops are sincere, but I believe they're sincerely wrong. Pulling our troops out before they've achieved their purpose is not a plan for victory.
As President Bush lays out what he calls his plan for victory, we'll speak with Congressmember Jose Serrano, one of only three Congress members out of more than 400 who voted for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. He's also one of only two to take up an offer by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for cheap oil for poor communities in the United States. Serrano represents the South Bronx. We'll also go to Iraq to get the latest on four kidnapped aid workers from the group Christian Peacemakers Team. And today marks the 50th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott, sparked by Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her bus seat to a white man.
I like that she was strong, and now since she did what she did, now we can sit wherever we want in the buses.
We'll hear voices from outside Rosa Parks' memorial service in Washington last month. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a lengthy address at the U.S. Naval Academy, President Bush offered a staunch defense of the Iraq War Wednesday, rejecting growing calls for a military withdrawal. This is President Bush.
As the Iraqi forces gain experience and the political process advances, we will be able to decrease our troop levels in Iraq without losing our capability to defeat the terrorists. These decisions about troop levels will be driven by the conditions on the ground in Iraq and the good judgment of our commanders, not by artificial timetables set by politicians in Washington.
President Bush speaking Wednesday at the U.S. Naval Academy. Bush's speech coincided with the White House's release of a 35-page national strategy for victory in Iraq. We'll have more from Bush's speech later in the broadcast. Calls for an immediate troop withdrawal have been bolstered by the stance taken by the hawkish Democratic Congressmember John Murtha. Following Bush's speech, Murtha appeared on MSNBC's Hardball. This was his response.
When you lose the support in the guerrilla war, you can't win it. Mao Zedong said years ago, you got to have the will of the people in order to win a guerrilla war. 80% of the people in Iraq want us out. 45% say it's justified to kill Americans. They even had an official communique from the Arab world that said it's all right to kill Americans. We have lost the support of the Iraqi people.
Democratic Congressmember John Murtha of Pennsylvania. Also Wednesday, Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi became the first congressional leader to endorse Congressmember Murtha's call for an immediate U.S. troop withdrawal. Pelosi and other top Democrats had initially distanced themselves from his position. But Pelosi told the Washington Post, quote, clearly a majority of the caucus supports Mr. Murtha in his plan to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq. Less than 2 weeks before his scheduled execution, the California Supreme Court has rejected a motion to reopen the case against death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams. Defense lawyers argued questionable forensic testing and other errors could have led to Williams' wrongful conviction. Since his imprisonment in 1981, Tookie Williams has become a leading advocate against gang violence and has been nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize. Williams is scheduled to die by lethal injection on December 13th. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will hold a clemency hearing next week. On Wednesday, Schwarzenegger said, quote, what I want to do is make sure we make the right decisions because we're dealing here with a person's life. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear the extended interview we did with Stanley Tookie Williams from his death row cell at San Quentin this week. Documents released Wednesday show Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito advocated slowly undoing the legalization of abortion during his stint as a government lawyer 20 years ago. In an internal Justice Department memo, he wrote in May 1985 how a high court review of two abortion-related cases is, quote, an opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade and, in the meantime, of mitigating its effects. In a development in the growing uproar over alleged CIA secret prisons in Europe, the Guardian of London says it's obtained flight logs showing more than 300 CIA flights have landed at European airports. The Washington Post recently reported the CIA has been operating secret prisons in former Soviet states in Eastern Europe. At the request of the Pentagon, the Post did not name the countries. The disclosure prompted the European Union Justice Commissioner to threaten sanctions against any member state found to have hosted a secret CIA prison. According to The Guardian, CIA planes visited both Germany and Britain over 80 times. On Wednesday, the State Department announced it'll respond shortly to European requests for an explanation on the alleged prisons. In a move that's angered local politicians and health advocates, the Environmental Protection Agency has announced it will no longer test for World Trade Center dust contamination in Brooklyn and north of Canal Street in Manhattan. The suspension of testing in the areas came as part of a $7 million reduced testing plan. Testing will also exclude buildings set for demolition. The EPA also announced it's halting a panel of toxicologists, doctors, environmentalists, and residents formed to review the testing. The panel's last meeting will be held in December. In a statement, Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York said, quote, "This testing and cleanup plan is a breathtaking slap at the residents and workers of Lower Manhattan." Once again, EPA is quite callously demonstrating that the health and safety of those affected by 9/11 are simply not a priority, he said. In Israel, veteran Israeli statesman Shimon Peres announced his widely expected departure from the Labor Party to support the new Kadima Party of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. This is Shimon Peres.
I spoke with Mr. Sharon, and I'm convinced that he is determined, as I am, to continue with the peace process immediately after the elections. He is open to creative ideas and achieving peace and security as soon as possible. I decided, therefore, to support his election and cooperate with him to realize those goals.
Shimon Peres speaking on Wednesday. In return for his support, Peres will be appointed to a top cabinet position if Sharon's party wins national elections in March. Four leaders of Ethiopia's main opposition party have announced a hunger strike to protest detentions that have left them in prison for close to a month. The four are top leaders of the Coalition for Unity and Democracy. On Saturday, hundreds of Ethiopian Americans rallied outside President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, in support of the imprisoned leaders. And today marks the 25th anniversary of World AIDS Day. Since 1981, AIDS has claimed the lives of more than an estimated 20 million people. In the United States alone, an estimated 1 million Americans are now living with HIV, with at least 35,000 new infections occurring a year. In the southern African country of Malawi, UNICEF estimates over 500,000 children have lost at least one parent to AIDS. In India, at least 4.5 million people live with HIV, the most in any country outside South Africa. This is Pranoy Dutta of the Indian NGO, the Sanata Foundation.
Actually, you see, this is for awareness. 4.5 million people are affected in AIDS. And you know, everybody can be HIV positive. And awareness is the better than cure. So without awareness, we can't. There is no medicine for AIDS. So only for awareness.
Pranoy Dutta of the India Sanata Foundation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. A group of influential Sunni scholars is calling for the release of five Westerners taken hostage last week in Iraq. The Association of Muslim Scholars said the captives should be granted their freedom as a humanitarian gesture. The group has helped mediate the release of kidnapped foreigners in the past. The five captives include four aid workers from the humanitarian group Christian Peacemaker Teams, two Canadians, a Briton, and an American, as well as German archaeologist Suzanne Ostoff, who was seized with her Iraqi driver last Friday. Ostoff was working for a German aid organization distributing medical supplies in Iraq since before the 2003 U.S. invasion. The group of Sunni scholars said releasing her would recognize Germany's, quote, positive stance on Iraq.
The Association of Muslim Scholars said the release of the four aid workers from Christian Peacemaker Teams would recognize their, quote, good efforts in helping those in need. The non-missionary aid group has been operating in Iraq since 2002 and has had a presence in Gaza and the West Bank for the past decade. It's previously operated in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and Bosnia. In the West Bank city of Ramallah, the top Palestinian Muslim cleric, Mufti Ikrima Sabri, also called for their release. The four members of the group were taken captive Saturday and appeared in a video broadcast by Al Jazeera. The video bears all the insignia of a group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. They accuse the four of being undercover spies working as Christian peace activists. In the tape, the men identify themselves on camera.
My name is Norman Kemba. I am 74 and I'm a member of the Christian peacemaking team in Iraq.
My name is Hermit Susan, I'm 32, and I'm working on a volunteer for CPT in Iraq.
My name is James Loney, I am 41 years old, I am from Canada, and I am part of the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq.
My name is Tom Fox, I'm 54 years old, I'm from the United States, and I'm a member of Christian Peacemaker Teams in Iraq.
We go now to Iraq to speak with Sami Rasuli. He's a member of the Muslim Peacemaker Team, which he founded in Iraq in conjunction with the Christian Peacemaker Teams. He joins us on the phone from Najaf. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sami.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. I met Sami in Minneapolis, where he was running a Middle Eastern restaurant, a very popular watering hole in Minneapolis. And I know a lot of people listening on KFAI and Twin Cities on public access in St. Paul know Sami very well. Well, he moved back to his home to Iraq. Can you talk about the four peacemakers? You know Tom Fox in particular from Virginia?
Yes, Tom Fox is a friend of mine who I met about 8 months ago. First time it was when we together took action in the city of Fallujah. About 15 members of the Muslim Peacemakers Team from Najaf and Karbala was accompanied by three members of CPT. One of them was my friend Tom. And we did the cleanup action in Fallujah on that day, the whole day. Then before that also, Tom and I, we made two preparation visit to Fallujah. And after that, we did also visit Fallujah after my arrival to the to Iraq last August. The first day I arrived on August 24th at the CPT house in Baghdad in Qurada. I learned that next day there was a visit to Fallujah scheduled, so I joined them with that visit. And Tom was with me, and then we did another visit with Anita David, Tom and I too. And last action also we accompanied some families, Palestinian families that sought refuge to Syria, but we couldn't cross a Syrian border. So we said we stayed there about, I stayed about 5 nights with them, but he stayed about 2 weeks. Then came back. And last time we met was sometime, I think, in November 1st, where we made another visit to Fallujah after we were invited to meet the cleric Mosque in Al Furqan Mosque, the Sheikh, and also a dentist doctor in his clinic to tell us about the situation during Ramadan. I was really saddened when I heard that news while I was in Karbala waiting for the group, those guest group coming were supposed to be scheduled to come in, to Karbala and Najaf next day on the 27th of November and 28th of November. But then the news that we got, since then we're busy working the MPT with the CPT closely to find ways how to get them safely released. And today I in Najaf right now talking to you. I came yesterday from Karbala to get a promise from the young cleric Sayyid Muqtada Sadr office to issue a statement to talk about the CPT and testify that they are not spies, and they're kidnappers, alleging because on September 26th, group of CPT delegates and CPT permanent residents in Baghdad, there were about eight of them with me. We met Sayyid Muqtada for about 90 minutes. We were discussing various issues that concerning the Iraqi situation and before the referendum on the constitution. And team next day left, and I think they stayed a couple of days and left Iraq, except the permanent resident who always they've been in Iraq since October 2002.
Sammy, I'd like to ask you, the Christian peacemaker team as well as the Muslim peacemaker team, what activity precisely were they involved in? I understand the Christian peacemaker team was not a missionary group. So what did the day-to-day activities of both groups involve?
The Christian peacemakers team are a group who were established in 1986 from Mennonites, Quakers, and Brethren Church. And they are really not missionaries, and also they are not a charity organization. They don't provide any humanitarian help, material help, as such as money or medical assistance, medicine, and so forth. But they provide, really, they offer their lives in a lethal situation, hot spot where violence erupts. I was talking to friends that they know CPT, and they speak with really frustration and sadness about their ordeal today. But I was replying, telling them that, well, if we have a peaceful Iraq today, you don't see Christian peacemakers around. They are in Colombia because there is a conflict. They are in Palestine because there is a conflict, and they are in Canada, mediating between the native citizen and the Canadian government because there is some conflict about land and so forth. And today they expanded their mission down in Africa. So,
but specifically, what do they do when they go into one of these hot spots?
In Iraq, they brought Shiites, Muslims, and Sunnis together. They help us. We were inspired by their action to travel all these thousands of miles across the ocean to come here in Iraq and speak about peace, promote nonviolence. And they are so steady and consistent in visiting the same place they did visit many times, just to lay down the sense of community and friendship.
We're talking to Sami Rasuli, who has lived in the United States for many years, an Iraqi who has returned home to Karbala and Najaf, speaking to us from Najaf. I wanted to ask you about Tom Fox. In the video that was shown on Al Jazeera of the four Christian peacemakers, when they go to Tom Fox, they also go to his credentials. He has a Marine ID. He was a U.S. Marine, a Quaker for 20 years. He talked a lot around September 11th about his feelings and wanting to change the record, I guess you could say, of the United States, wanting to bring peace to the world. Do you think that could weigh in here with the way the video hones in on that military ID?
I haven't seen him and talking in the video, but I understood Tom, he's tall, more than 6 feet. I don't know exactly how tall is he, and he's bold, and many times I've been approached by Iraqis, whether in Fallujah, Karbala, Baghdad, and even in the Syrian borders, when the Syrian authority didn't allow us to get in, so they throw us on the no man land where lots of violence activities take place, like kidnapping, killing, and we were warned even by the Syrian authority there are many criminals in that area. So my most concern was about him. So we tried to cover his head with this checker red kufiya to hide his identity and give him a newspaper to read, because lots of people were around looking and staring at us. And so the people who approached me asked me, who is this guy and what he's doing here? So he was like his just shape raising lots of questions among Iraqis. I've seen Iraqis coming, approaching the CPT members, asking for Bibles, but they rejected and apologized politely that we don't have Bibles. If you need a Bible, telling the Iraqis, you can go to any Iraqi church in Baghdad to get that. So outlook, it looks like it brings some suspicion, and I knew that he worked before, as I understood, in Washington as a musician, but Tom is a loving, peaceful, quiet guy. He has lots of gifts, where the team in the CPT team in Baghdad, when I visit them and they have meetings, he keeps calm, not speaking or discussing anything till the last minute. And when you listen to him, you sense all the righteousness and all the wisdom. And finally, his points that he made or he makes, it will be well taken, and would be the final conclusion where the CPT MPT take an action upon.
Well, Sami Rasuli, we want to thank you very much for joining us, who has set up the Muslim peacemaker team modeled on the Christian peacemaker team. Sami, speaking to us from Najaf, the four Christian peacemakers still kidnapped in Iraq. And again, a lot of people from Tom's community in Virginia, one of the four, talk about how central he was to the Quaker community there in his desire for peace and wanting to represent the United States differently than the military has in the past, which is why he went to Iraq to bear witness and help people, joining his three colleagues at Christian Peacemaker Team. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be speaking about Iraq and also the congressmember who is one of two who has taken up Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez on his offer for cheap oil to poor communities in the United States. We'll be speaking with New York Congressmember Jose Serrano, and we'll be remembering Rosa Parks. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
President Bush sought to overcome mounting criticism of the Iraq War Wednesday in what the White House billed as a major address outlining the administration's strategy. In a 45-minute speech before the U.S. Naval Academy, Bush again rejected a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and recounted improvements made by Iraqi security forces. The speech was the first in a series of four Bush plans to give before the December 15th parliamentary elections. The president yesterday reiterated that Iraqi troops will eventually take over from U.S. forces fighting the insurgency.
Our goal is to train enough Iraqi forces so they can carry the fight. And this will take time and patience. And it's worth the time. And it's worth the effort. Because Iraqis and Americans share a common enemy. And when that enemy is defeated in Iraq, Americans will be safer here at home. And as the Iraqi security forces stand up, coalition forces can stand down. And when our mission of defeating the terrorists in Iraq is complete, our troops will return home to a proud nation.
President Bush repeatedly linked U.S. withdrawal to improvements in the capability of the Iraqi forces. But the mainstream media has recently detailed the existence of death squads within the largely Shiite police and special commandos operating through or with the Iraqi security forces. These militias have abducted, tortured, and executed hundreds, perhaps thousands of Sunnis. The New York Times reported Tuesday, quote, some Sunni males have been found dead in ditches and fields with bullet holes in their temples, acid burns on their skin, holes in their bodies apparently made by electric drills. Many have simply vanished, the paper said. At a Pentagon news conference Tuesday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was questioned about the death squads.
Mr. Secretary, are you concerned over, and in fact, the United States looking into growing reports of uniformed death squads in Iraq, perhaps assassinating and torturing hundreds of Sunnis? And if that's true, what would that say about stability in Iraq?
Comment on hypothetical questions. I've not seen reports that hundreds are being killed by roving death squads at all. We know for a fact that it's a violent country. We know for a fact that there have been various militias. We know that there have been some militias that have been Iran-oriented. We also know there's been some militias in the north that have been very helpful. The Peshmerga have been very constructive in what they've done. But I'm not going to get into speculation like that.
Well, sir, that's not a hypothetical, I don't believe. The Sunnis themselves are charging that hundreds have been assassinated, people shot in the head, found in alleys.
What you're talking about are unverified, to my knowledge at least, unverified comments. I just don't have any data from the field that I could comment on in a specific way. Do you, General?
No, I do not, sir, although I do know that the Iraqi government has said that they were going to investigate those kinds of allegations.
And they should. That's a good thing. Look, it's a sovereign country. The Iraqi government exists. There's also a political campaign taking place, and we ought to be aware of that, that there are going to be a lot of charges and countercharges and allegations, and they may very well be timed, as they are in every country in the world that has a free political system. They may be timed in a way to seek advantage. We also will find that in some cases that there will be investigations and that they will prove to have been valid. I just don't know. I can only talk about what I know. That's life.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld at his news conference on Tuesday. Well, the story only recently made front page news. We first reported on it 6 months ago. Investigative journalist Arun Gupta was one of the first to report on the presence of death squads in Iraq back in April. We interviewed him at the time. He joins us in the studio now. Arun is editor of the New York City Independent Media Center's newspaper, The Independent. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
So lay out what you're seeing right now in Iraq.
What you're seeing is, I think, really the fruition of U.S. strategy in Iraq. The Pentagon has spent over $10 billion to try to stand up Iraqi military forces, and it's been a complete disaster. So what they're trying to do is they're turning to death squads to fight the insurgency. The Iraqi forces, the military forces, the army, they really don't stand and fight. And even when they do, they depend on tremendous U.S. logistical support to carry out any operation. So they really can't operate on their own. But there are these militias that Donald Rumsfeld was talking about. But, of course, what he doesn't want to talk about is that the U.S. set up these militias. They funded them. They armed them. They trained them. And a lot of this came out in the Pentagon's own reports, Pentagon's generals talking about how great they were over a year ago, how they really took the fight to the resistance. And so what's been going on is that the U.S. has set these up, and there's been a certain conflict. In April, when the Shiite government took control, they started firing a lot of the commanders who were basically ex-Baptists, and they started bringing in their own guys, especially from the Badr Brigade. And a lot of these are concentrated in what's known as the special police commandos, and they have all sorts of various brigades, one called the Wolf Brigade, the Scorpion Brigade, the Lion Brigade, another called the Fearless Warriors. And they sound like death squads, and they are death squads. They go around with masks. They're conducting these raids, especially throughout Baghdad. And the U.S. is saying, well, you know, who knows who's doing this? But when 20 vehicles pull up with 100 troops in them, and reporters are recounting, the New York Times article also recounts this, they're showing up with sophisticated communications equipment, they're showing up with these expensive Glocks, 9mm Glocks that were supplied by the U.S. government, they have the insignia, the uniforms of the special police commandos, and in Baghdad there's a very strict curfew that's in place every single night. Yet how can these large convoys of vehicles be going around? And so they conduct these roundups, and in many areas it's largely Sunni Arab males, and then they're disappeared. They're taken into this network of secret prisons. One of the things that's come out is that there's this absolutely vast network of prisons throughout Iraq. In a nation of 27 million, the Iraqi government has 1,100 prisons.
Outside the U.S. prisons.
This is in addition to the U.S. prisons. Officially, the Iraqi government says they only have about 12,000-13,000 detainees, but that really strains credibility. That's only 11 prisoners per facility. Whereas what really set this all off was the uncovering of a secret detention center within an interior ministry building where they found approximately 170 men. Another Iraqi male spoke extensively to Reuters where he was kept in a building with 800 men. The BBC just published a report and photographs of another prison that they were allowed to enter, which showed a room so crowded that the prisoners could barely sit down. So nobody knows even really how many prisoners are being held by the Iraqi government. And what's been happening is that they're being you're finding all these men being seized, primarily it looks like Sunni Arab males who are thought to form the core of the armed resistance. And then bodies are turning up weeks, months later, often two or three governments away. So they're seized in Baghdad, for instance, and then these 20, 30 bodies will turn up on the Iranian border. And that part of the area is completely controlled by Shiite militias. The Sunni resistance has very little presence down there.
Now, when you mentioned these death squads, you mentioned the Badr Brigades. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr has been an opponent of the U.S. occupation, and
yes.
And he's been hunted at, several times by U.S. forces. Are you saying that there's at the same time ongoing cooperation by some of his people with?
Well, the Badr Brigade is linked to the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was based in Iran. Al-Sadr's forces are distinct, the Mahdi Army. And in the words of one high-ranking U.S. official who spoke to the L.A. Times, he said that the Badr Brigade has the special commandos and the Mahdi Army has the police in Baghdad. He said, quote, everybody's got their own death squads. Now, this is a high-ranking U.S. military official, and this is admitted by also Iraqi officials.
We only have a minute to go, Arun, but the issue of U.S. military advisors to these death squads.
There are two advisors in particular. One is named Steve Castell. He was a high-ranking intelligence officer with the Drug Enforcement Agency throughout Latin America, and he was actually in charge of the Interior Ministry until the handover of sovereignty on June 28, 2004. And the other is Jim Steele, who was in charge of special forces, a team of 55 special forces in El Salvador during that brutal counterinsurgency war, where they trained Salvadoran forces and oversaw a very brutal counterinsurgency war where tens of thousands were killed by death squads. And both of these are operating in the Interior Ministry. So the idea that this is going on without U.S. knowledge, it's plausible deniability is what they're trying to do.
Arun Gupta, I want to thank you for being with us. Arun is with the Independent, the newspaper of the New York Indy Media Center, your website where documents will be up.
Yes, there'll be the reports over the last 6 months that we've been publishing that are available at nyc.indymedia.org.
And, of course, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, where we will link to the New York Indy Media Center. This is Democracy Now! As we broadcast on close to 400 radio and television stations around the country, Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on Channel 375 of DirecTV. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Juan?
We turn now to the issue of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and his offer of cheap oil for poor U.S. communities. New York Congressmember Jose Serrano is one of the few members of Congress promoting this effort. He's also one of the few to have voted last month for an immediate withdrawal from Iraq. And we want to talk briefly to him about that before we get into the oil situation.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Serrano.
Well, thank you so much, Amy and Juan, for having me on the show.
It's great to have you on with us. In just a minute, we're going to go to the issue of cheap oil for poorer communities in this country. But given the series of speeches that President Bush is giving on why the U.S. should not withdraw from Iraq immediately, you're one of three Congress members to have voted for immediate withdrawal. Why?
Well, first of all, because it's something I have been saying. If you look at your file on Serrano press releases, you'll see that on something like six or seven occasions, I've said immediate withdrawal, and I've been accused of being irresponsible, but I've said the same way we got in, without asking any questions of anyone, we should get out, and immediate withdrawal means exactly that. So even though it's been reported, and we know it to be true, that what you saw a couple of weeks ago in Congress was really a sham by the Republicans to put up and try to embarrass Jack Murtha's withdrawal proposal, which I support in terms of I support any withdrawal proposal, but I'd rather have one yesterday or this morning. So I voted for it because I felt that that proposal, even though it was put up for them as a sort of an insult to Martha or as a sham, it was still exactly the language that I want.
And yesterday, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also apparently backed Congressman Murtha's position, so that you're seeing more motion now, apparently, on the Congress, more toward more voices calling for withdrawal.
Well, I think what you're seeing is a situation where the most respected person in terms of supporting the military has come out and said, we can't win this. We're not doing the right thing. We have to get out. Our presence creates the problem. And so, you know, with all due respect to myself, I could yell it from the top of a mountain, and people say, well, it's the usual Serrano peace movement. When with Jack Murtha, who's a highly decorated soldier and who has always been supportive of military action and the military, says we can't win it, the fact that he agrees with what we've been saying for years is not the issue. The issue is that when he says it, people begin to listen. And he gives a lot of people sitting on the fence a lot of cover, because it's hard to attack them when the Republicans have tried that.
Congressmember Sedano, we have to break. When we come back, we want to ask you about Venezuelan oil in the South Bronx. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, back in 60 seconds.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, and saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there.
You got it. Frank Sinatra singing My Way. I think an appropriate song for our guest, Congressmember Sedano, one of three Congress members to vote for total withdrawal from Iraq immediately, and one of two to accept Venezuelan President Chavez's offer of cheap oil. Poor residents in the South Bronx section of New York City and in Boston, Massachusetts, will be receiving a huge gift this winter: inexpensive home heating oil from Venezuela. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez recently completed historic agreements with Congressmember Jose Serrano of New York and William Delahunt of Massachusetts. Under the agreement, Citgo, the Houston-based American subsidiary of Venezuela's state-owned oil company, will provide 8 million gallons of discounted home heating oil to the South Bronx and 12 million gallons to low-income residents of Boston.
Tens of thousands of people are expected to benefit from the deals, which could produce savings of more than $20 million. The deal comes as Chavez continues to fiercely criticize President Bush. Last month at the Latin American summit in Argentina, he led a rally of 25,000 people to protest Bush and his economic policies in the region. The deal also comes as U.S. oil companies have come under scrutiny for their record-high profits, while at the same time, oil prices are expected to reach record-high levels this winter. Congressmember Serrano told the New York Times that the Citgo deal, quote, sends an incredible message to other oil companies. It tells them that if these people in Venezuela can share their profits with poorer communities, then they should, too. Chavez first made the offer in August in Caracas. He made it again 2 months ago during an interview with Democracy Now! At that time, Chavez said the Venezuelan company Citgo has 14,000 gas stations and 8 refineries in the U.S. He went on to outline his offer of cheap oil.
We want to use these infrastructures to help the poor populations. We have made some progress. We have given instructions to the president of Citgo, Felix Rodriguez. We want that up to 10% we refine here. We supply every day to the U.S. 1.5 million barrels of oil, crude and product. And we refine here close to 800,000 barrels a day refined here in the U.S. So we would like to take 10% of what we refine, those products, and to offer these products in several modalities to the poor populations.
That was Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaking on Democracy Now! In September. As we continue our conversation with Jose Serrano, there's a full-page ad in the New York Times today. It says how Venezuela is keeping the home fires burning in Massachusetts. And there is an ad for PDVSA and Citgo on the bottom. Well, Jose Serrano, tell us about why you've taken up the Venezuelan president on his offer.
Well, first of all, let me just take 1 second to thank you and Juan both for giving me my daily dose of Frank Sinatra, which I must have to continue my work. And I thought that was very cute and very appropriate. I don't know how much Juan had to do with that.
We know you're a big fan of it.
I'm a fanatic. The word is fanatic, but that's another issue for another day. When Hugo Chavez was scheduled to come to New York for the UN, I, as you know, have been a strong supporter of his attempts at bringing social justice to Venezuela, and I have been a strong critic of our administration's desire to undo his government and to try to overthrow him and who knows what else. So I thought it was a great opportunity to invite him to the Bronx, and he wanted to meet with community organizations, and you all reported on that visit. It was a wonderful visit. As part of the visit, he mentioned different things, student exchange programs, assistance with a greenway that we're building in the Bronx, some ecological, environmental issues, having parents go to Venezuela and deal with parents who are organizing over there, all kinds of things. And the oil issue came up. And, of course, I thought it was a wonderful opportunity. We immediately ran into one little problem, and that is that President Chavez himself thought that we were talking about homeowners. And I explained to him that for the most part in my district, we have tenements, we have housing groups, and that we have landlords as such. I have probably a very small, if not the smallest amount of homeowners. So that's what kept us from getting this off the ground as quickly as we wanted to. What we did is, as part of the pilot program, we went out and we selected 3 housing corporations, which Juan has been very strongly trying to get the names from, and he will have them soon, of 3 corporations, non-for-profit, who oversee X amount of buildings, and they will receive the oil that then will be administered to these buildings with the understanding, and please understand that this was put forth by the Venezuelan government, with the understanding that the 40% savings will be returned to the tenants and to the community organization, to the tenants in forms of either food vouchers that they could use at local supermarkets and or rent reductions, and the other part of that 40% to go for human infrastructure repairs in the program, in the housing stock as is. So no one makes a penny on this, and no one is supposed to save any money. They're supposed to reinvest it in the community corporation that runs these buildings.
And are there plans, as far as you know, to expand this? The advertisement in the Times does suggest that there may be an expansion beyond just Boston and the South Bronx to the project.
Well, first of all, there are plans to expand it within the South Bronx. For instance, as soon as we get all the kinks out of it, and somebody may say, and you have, you know, what's the holdup? It's not really a holdup. It's just that it's not every day that a South Bronx non-for-profit group signs a deal with an international corporation. So everything had to be looked at carefully. But we intend to, if it works properly, expand it in the Bronx. And yes, there's talk about Chicago and there's talk about other communities. In fact, in Chicago, there's talk about the bus lines that operate in the poorer neighborhoods. So it's really an open issue as to how much help they can give us. And I think it's important for all folks to understand, because I think the biggest confusion is, you know, Chavez is taking this out of Venezuela. No, this is from the resources that it has been allocated already to be sold in the United States. So all that you're really seeing is an American corporation based in the United States doing what others refuse to do, which is reducing their price.
Have you received pressure, or has Congressmember Delahunt received pressure from the Bush administration since they've made him, perhaps after Iraq and a few other countries, the number one enemy of this country, Chavez?
No pressure. And I think what's happening, and I heard a report on NPR where they were asking this professor from Boston how should they handle it, and they said the best thing the administration should do is leave it alone, because you can't win this argument. You cannot attack Hugo Chavez for doing what all corporations should be doing in this country. And again, what people need to know is that Citgo may be owned by Venezuela, but it has operated as an American corporation under our laws. They pay taxes here. They get tax breaks the way other corporations get it. So, and number two, when Citgo put forth, I think it was $10 million for Katrina and opened up a center of relief, the administration didn't complain about that and did not demand to return the money. And Citgo employs, I believe it's over 4,200 residents of this country in their different refineries that they have in their distribution. So it's totally legitimate. And I think the administration is best served if they just leave it alone. Now, the press has been coming after us, of course. You know, some are even suggesting that, you know, he's buying members of Congress. Well, for the record, before I even knew they could give us oil, I was a strong supporter of his government and his revolution.
Also, at least one Republican has embraced the idea. Mayor Bloomberg, the Republican mayor of New York, was asked recently if oil was made available to some of the public schools, which my understanding is that President Chavez has said it might include schools in poor communities. The mayor was asked, would he accept the oil? And he said he'd be glad to get discounted oil from wherever he could get it to cut the school costs for New York City.
And it's something that we are going to be presenting to the embassy and to the Venezuelans. You know, with all the respect to the mayor, I don't know if he said that tongue-in-cheek, sarcastically, or straight up. If it is, then, again, you know, this could start. The big deal here is, will other corporations pick up on it? As you have well reported and other people have reported, these people are making more money than anyone else in the country right now. Their profits go beyond anything you can imagine, to the point where a Republican-controlled Congress has brought up the possibility of asking questions about their profits. So there's plenty of money for reductions in prices.
Congressmember Jose Serrano, we have to leave it there. You said you support the revolution in Venezuela. We'll see if it starts a revolution here in the United States around the issue of cheaper oil.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Congressmember Jose Serrano joining us from Washington represents the South Bronx. Juan?
Well, today marks the 50th anniversary of the start of the Montgomery bus boycott. Civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks was arrested December 1st, 1955, for violating segregation laws when she refused to give up her seat on a city bus to a white man. Civil rights leaders called for a one-day boycott of the city's segregated bus buses days later. On December 5th, 90% of Montgomery's black citizens stayed off the buses. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led the boycott that stretched on for over a year. 50,000 boycotters carpooled, used church vehicles, and walked to work for 381 days.
The bus boycott ended soon after the Supreme Court ruled bus segregation unconstitutional in 1956. Rosa Parks became known as the mother of the civil rights movement. She died last month at the age of 92 and was the first woman to lie in honor at the U.S. Capitol. I went with my colleagues Yoruba Richin and Elizabeth Press of Democracy Now! To Washington for Rosa Parks' memorial service in Washington, D.C. Thousands of people crowded in to the Metropolitan Church, and thousands were outside. We spoke to some of them.
I have my own little piece to connect with her act of courage. When I was 17 years old in 1941, on my way back to college, I boarded the Greyhound bus in my little village in the northern neck of Virginia, and I sat in the second seat from the front. We had not gone 5 miles before the bus driver stopped. Anticipating this might happen, I had opened my book to read. The bus driver rose from his seat, came, stood over my seat, and said to me, "You're in the wrong seat." I did not look up from my book. He said, "You belong in the back of the bus." My eyes were fastened on the pages of my book, and I was terrified. I knew not what was going to happen next. However, the bus driver continued his command. He said, "You must move to the back of the bus," and reinforced it by saying, "The ICC ruling does not affect your journey because this bus does not go interstate." I did not look at him. I read my book. He, realizing that I was not going to respond to his order, made a decision. He turned on his heels, walked back to his seat on the bus, nothing showing other than the crimson of his neck, went on to his destination, and there I was.
Why did you see keeping your seat on the bus as the defining issue then?
I had long decided that I was not going to allow anyone else to define who I am. I grew up in a home where people, my parents, were on the wall for justice all their lives. My father was a civil rights activist before I was born. He was a voter registration leader in the state of Virginia when poll tax prevented black people from voting. And he was determined, along with my mother's help, to do everything he could to make sure that all these barriers that denied people their humanity, basic humanity, would be broken down. And that's what we're talking about. We still have many barriers. However, we're working on them. As long as we're aware that the struggle continues, things will get better.
I'm Hank Wallace, and my father did a reverse Rosa Parks in 1944, 11 years before Rosa Parks kept her seat in the bus. In the Navy, in segregated Miami, my father, Irving Wallace, an optometrist in the Navy, would occasionally ride in the back of the segregated bus in order to make the point that he shouldn't get any special privileges because of his being white.
My name is James Washington from Metro Bus.
Can you tell us how old this bus is and why it's here today?
This bus is year 1957, and this is for Rosa Parks' funeral today. I'm really proud to be here, really proud to be here today.
My name is Jacqueline Williams.
And why are you here?
I'm here because my daughter, she begged me, absolutely begged me to bring her here because she loves Rosa Parks.
What is your name?
Teresa.
And how old are you?
10.
You're 10 years old. Why are you here? Why did you beg your mother to take you here?
Because I like Rosa Parks.
What do you like about her?
I like that she was strong and that now since She did what she did. Now we can sit wherever we want in the buses.
People remembering Rosa Parks. Today is the 50th anniversary of the day, December 1st, 1955, she sat down on that bus and refused to stand up for white men. Democracy Now!, produced by a wonderful team of people. Go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.